Thanks. Well, thank you, Mariangela, for the invitation. I got a little, there's been a lot of activity in this conference on the low energy frontier. We went down to molecules this morning, fascinating talk. So I thought I would up the stakes and go to the high energy frontier. And in fact, for neutrinos, the high energy frontier does take you, at least for cosmic neutrinos, to pretty remote places. This is a tank of the Auger cosmic ray detector in the Pampa Maria in Argentina, and it covers 3,000 square kilometers. That's one of 1,600 detectors which are sited on the plane. And before you get the idea that I'm some kind of an experimentalist, this is how fake news is generated. There was a graduate student who actually designed the card with which this antenna communicates with the geostationary satellite, and we just slotted it in and had him take a photograph. That's my colleague Luis Anchaduki from Argentina. Anyway, it's fun doing a shift. All the theorists have to do shifts on this experiment because shifts are actually pretty boring, so you get time to think about new ideas, and I'll tell you about one that we came up with. So this detector is not as specifically designed to detect neutrinos as the other one that Janet just talked about, namely IceCube, which is buried 2.5 kilometers below the pole. That, of course, is the artist's representation. That is the counting house on the surface. The actual detector is way down there somewhere. But that's what an event in IceCube looks like if you put it on a computer. And I'll talk more about what we have been able to actually do with IceCube with regard to measuring properties of neutrino interactions at very high energies. So we have been talking about electron volts and kilo electron volts, mainly in dark matter. So then you know mega electron volts and giga electron volts and tera electron volts. That's where the energy frontier in colliders is. But today we are going to go to beyond that to exa electron volts and zeta electron volts, okay? So this detector is that one there, the one that we are sitting on top of, and it's one of, as it says here, 1600 Voracherenkov detectors. So basically what they are is tanks containing about 12 tons of pure water looked at by three photomultipliers, which essentially detect the ionization due to any particles going through. And the kind of particles we are interested in are those generated by a high-energy cosmic ray hitting the atmosphere and generating an air shower. So at the energies I'll be talking about, by the time the shower hits the ground, it's got about 10 to the 11 particles in it, right? So that's as many particles as there are stars in our galaxy or galaxies in the universe. So you can imagine that simulating such an object is quite difficult and measuring it is quite difficult, so that's why the field was rather marginal for many years, but this experiment has kind of put it on the map. As I'll show you, we have reliable results with reliable energies and new physics that could possibly be extracted from it. We'll talk more about that. Now, apart from these detectors, each one of which is shown by a dot, this experiment is overlooked by four telescopes which are on little hills like that. And what they are is basically Schmidt cameras with very wide fields of view. So when it's totally dark, when it's moonless night, which is about 10% of the time, and this is a very remote area, that's why you go to a remote place, so it's totally dark at night, you can actually see that shower in the atmosphere because the ionization excites nitrogen molecules and you get a fluorescence emission which you can pick up from a sensitive telescope. With telescopes like that, you can, in fact, if situation is ideal, catch a shower from all four of them. And this, in fact, happened when I was on shift. This was about 11 years ago. And the particle that came in was estimated to have an energy of 10 to the 10 GeV. Now, this is a real particle. We are not talking about hypothetical particles, right? It's really exciting when that happens. Because this particular air shower, normally it would just leave an imprint on the ground and the coloring shows you where most of the activity was. And you can, in fact, measure the activity as a function of the radius away from that impact point. But if you had this air fluorescence detection, then you kind of have a calorimetric measurement of the energy. You just got to allow for the little bit that went into the ground. And this technique was pioneered by the fly's eye experiment in Utah, and then developed by Hi-Res, its successor. But Auger brought the innovation of adding the surface array detector so that we also know the acceptance very, very well, which you don't normally know if you just got two telescopes, because you don't really know what is the volume that you're really looking at least with one, just one telescope. So particles of these energies do exist in the universe. We have seen them. And the next question you might have is, well, I've heard that kind of thing before. How do you actually know the energy that well? And as I've already mentioned, that's because we can cross-calibrate the measurement of the energy in the surface array with the measurement with the fluorescence detector. Now, the surface array, what you actually measure is that all those PMTs have a flash ADC, so you can convert the signal into this spiky thing that you see here. That's a through-going muon, and then there's the electromagnetic shower. And this line that you see here is actually a theoretical formula due to Geiser and Hillers, which gives a pretty good description of the activity. And what they say is, if you just measure it at some fiducial point, in this case 1 kilometer from the core of the shower, that's a direct measurement of the total energy. And we know that that works because for the 10% of the showers that we can also measure with the fluorescence telescopes, there is a very nice correlation between the two, right? So there is no reliance on any simulations here. Having said that, the simulations aren't actually so bad, because when LHC first turned on, not many of you might know this, the cosmic ray shower simulations like QGS JET and Civil, which is more QCD inspired, this is a Gribov-Reger model, they in fact gave a better description of the first data from the LHC than did the in-house event generators like Pythia, which in fact had to have an extensive retune in order to account for the multiplicity of the new data. So we are, just for the benefit of those who are not familiar with this sort of things, we are looking at very high pseudorapidity when we look at cosmic ray interactions, because it's very forward physics. So this is literally orthogonal to what you do at a collider, where you look for high transverse momentum states, because those are indicative of new physics. You don't really want to look at the boring stuff in the forward direction, but in cosmic ray interactions, that's what you get, and that's what you have to understand. So obviously our theoretical understanding of that is limited, so most of the analysis is empirical, but we at least know how to measure the total energy. So if you plot the spectrum of the particles that you are thus measuring, you get this familiar plot. You would have seen it before, where the spectrum has been multiplied by e to the 2.5 to flatten it out a bit, otherwise it would drop like a stone. And this energy scale here is repeated up here in terms of the equivalent center of mass energy if you had a collider doing this. And you can see that the spectrum, which is a power law of slope with something like minus 2.7, up to about a TeV center of mass, at that point it turns over, and this is called the knee in the trade. And this is believed to be the point at which galactic cosmic ray accelerators like supernova remnants perhaps start giving up, because the particle is too energetic to be contained. And if you go up to higher energies, you see this spectrum cutting off, but a new spectrum coming in. It's got a much harder spectrum, and this is definitely extragalactic, because it cannot be contained by galactic magnetic fields. And this point, you have this second feature, and this feature, however, does not last forever, because when you get up to a center of mass energy of something of the order of few times 10 to the 5 GeV, which is, of course, needless to say, well beyond what any collider can do on the Earth, you see a cutoff in the spectrum, which could be due to the long sought for Grisen-Zaltzeppelin-Kuzmin process, because if to a proton at this energy, 10 to the 11 GeV, a microwave photon looks like a 100 MeV gamma ray in its own rest frame. So you can excite the 1232 state with a very large cross section, and that basically means that you can't propagate, you just will generate a lot of pions. Those pions will decay into neutrinos, and it is those that we'll be seeking later, right? The reason I put a question mark there is because This was actually predicted. In fact, it has been looked out for a long time. However, it could also be that the cosmic accelerators that are generating these particles simply can't accelerate particles beyond that energy, right? So the cutoff may not be an indication of the spectrum extending beyond that and being suppressed here. It might just be that there are no other particles. Now, how do we study this stuff? Well, we have typically to cover a lot of area with a lot of cheap detectors, because you're talking about, as I said, thousands of square miles here. If you can afford it, you also put detectors to study the muons, and Auger is in the process of installing an infill that does that. Or you might want to instrument a huge body of water or ice, again with photomultipliers. And so when the cascade comes in, you are essentially looking at the two-dimensional imprint of that on the ground, or you're looking at through-going muons, which of course have a huge range at these energies. And if you have telescopes that can look along the shower, you can pick up the Cherenkov light that is emitted by the particles along the direction they're going in, and those would be the gamma ray telescopes that you know about, like MAGIC or HESS or Veritas. And in addition to that, as I mentioned, you also get fluorescence radiation, which can be picked up by telescopes which are studying the air shower from a distance. This could be of order 30, 40, 50 kilometers. So you can see you can get a huge acceptance. This underground or underwater detector can also detect neutrinos which are coming through the Earth, which has screened out the muons, and which then generate a charge current event close to your detector. This is how IceCube works. But of course, it will also be getting a huge background of muons, which are coming from the interactions of the cosmic rays in the atmosphere. And typically, this signal is less than 10 millionth of that signal. So it's a huge problem to try to extract it from the background. And finally, in order to make bigger detectors, it turns out that the present scale of the experiments that you are building, which is of order a kilometer cube underground or several thousand square kilometers on the ground, is perhaps still too small, because the flux of these particles is very, very small. I forgot to mention that at that point where the ankle comes in the spectrum, you get one event per square kilometer per year. So that's why, of course, you might wonder why with such free particles around, why do you bother to build multi-billion dollar colliders? The flux is, pathetically small. So you need to build a big detector. The way forward may be to be able to detect the showers, whether in the atmosphere or in the ice or in the water, from the radio signals that they generate. And this is something under development. The current state of the art is experiments like ANITA, which fly on a balloon around the Antarctic, or other experiments like ARA and ARIANA, which are right now being developed. I'll mention something about them towards the end. So it is not that we are in competition with colliders. Obviously, because of the flux that I mentioned, there's no competition at all. You need colliders with controlled beam and high flux. But the point is that although in principle we can point to this fact that a high energy cosmic ray such as the one that I showed you actually exists, can give you a huge center of mass, that by itself is no good, because we are talking about a small rate, but more importantly, the kind of physics that we are seeing here is a hadronic interaction that's got a cross section of order inverse GeV square. But the new physics that we are after is at least inverse TeV square, possibly much, much smaller than that. So you aren't going to be able to see new physics in a hadronic interaction, okay? Unless, you're very, very fortunate. So that's why we are interested in neutrinos, because neutrinos interact very, very weakly to start with. And therefore, if there is some dramatic change in their interactions due to new physics, this might have a larger relative effect on what you are measuring, and that therefore is something which is more promising. Now, I should emphasize that this by new physics, I do not just mean beyond the standard model. There could be new physics in the standard model, because what we call the standard model is by and large the perturbative standard model, right? There's lots of interesting new phenomenon in the non-perturbative aspects of the standard model, and I'll give you two examples. One will be a possible formation of what's called a color glass condensate in QCD at very low PUCNX, and the other will be the possibility of exciting so-called spherons, which are transitions between the different vacuum states in the SU2 sector of the theory. And it turns out that both of these possibilities can be probed by high-energy cosmic neutrinos. So where do you get the neutrinos from? Well, we saw the cosmic rays, so therefore there must be neutrinos because they interact with the matter either when they are formed or as they propagate towards us. And the propagation part, I already mentioned, the GZK interactions of these cosmic rays with the intervening photons. And this is called the guaranteed cosmic ray cosmogenic flux. But actually it is not guaranteed, because if the primaries are not protons but heavy nuclei, then they are not going to make pions. They're rather going to break up into the constituent nucleons. The threshold for that is of order tens of MeV. So you don't actually make too many pions. You make a lot of neutrons, which then do decay and give you anti-electron neutrinos, but their cross-section for interaction is smaller, and also they're at a lower energy, so they're not as good. Of course, the sources of the cosmic rays, whatever they are, we don't know what they are, but some possible suspects are active galactic nuclei. These are these giant supermassive black holes at the centers of galaxies, which are accreting matter, shooting out jets of plasma, etc. Or they could be gamma ray bursts, and I've put, you know, this is to just indicate that neither of these, of course, so far have been identified as possible cosmic neutrino sources, so you wonder if there are other weird things out there that you don't know about, which have intense magnetic fields or are large enough to contain them, contain the cosmic rays, that is. And these, therefore, do not so much offer us a specific target as a likely source of likely flux of neutrinos, which I'll talk about, which is often referred to by the names of Boxman and Bakal, who first set a limit from just a calorimetric argument that whatever sources produce the cosmic rays must be generating neutrinos at some level. However, this is also not a hard number. It is sensitive to the energy at which that angle came in, because when you integrate over a falling power spectrum, the total energy is sensitive to the lower limit, and the lower limit is where that change in the slope occurs, and if that is higher or lower, the energy requirement changes considerably. Another possible contact with new physics is that the cosmic neutrinos we are seeing might be from decays of new relics from the Big Bang, and this has been talked about many years ago in the context of possible topological defects, cosmic strings, and so on, decaying into neutrinos, or more recently I've talked about super heavy dark matter, and all this was very fashionable about 15 years ago when this air shower array in Japan claimed to actually see events that extended beyond the GZK cutoff, and these were nonetheless isotropic on the sky. So if you ask what is isotropic on the sky but very nearby, so that they are not attenuated by interactions in the microwave background, then the thing that you think of is the halo of our galaxy. And so some of us try to work out whether this could be coming from decays of supermassive particles. Unfortunately, when a supermassive particle decays, it will not make nucleons. It will mostly make photons, about 10 times more photons than nucleons, just as when a Z boson decays, it makes many more photons than nucleons. And so you can look in the data, I will not discuss that for lack of time, you can look in the data to see whether the highest energy cosmic rays are photons or nucleons, and Auger definitively showed us that it's not photons. So this theories have all been ruled out. So let's go to the more conventional sources of cosmic rays and indeed of neutrinos, which is some object that is generating a high energy beam of particles. And this is the calorimetric argument that I alluded to, which just says that we are generating cosmic rays at some rate over some time scale, and some fraction of that is being converted into neutrinos. And these numbers would come from the precise, whether it's a P-gamma reaction or a PP reaction, etc. But you can see that order of magnitude, this is going to give us an estimate of the expected flux. And that turns out to be a number of this order, right? And with this number, you can then try and estimate how big a detector you need to see this flux. And that's turns out to be of order a kilometer cube at energies of a TeV, and that's why the ice cube and other experiments like that were designed to be that big. So of course you can, this was quoted actually as an upper limit, but if I put in some numbers here for these things, parameters, I can get a flux expectation, and it would be higher if the crossover energy from extragalactic to galactic happened at a lower energy, because that means more energy has to be put in by the sources. So it's uncertain, but something that we have to keep an eye on. Same story with the cosmogenic flux. The same protons or heavy nuclei or whatever, as they are coming towards us, will generate neutrinos through interactions on the cosmic microwave background. This is for protons. And you see here, you make both pions and you make also neutrons. This thing here, this peak, is from the neutron decays. This is from the pion decays. And this, as I said, is at a lower energy, so is of less interest. The one that is most interesting is this one, because muon neutrinos are also easier to detect, much more easy to detect, because they leave a long track, the muon that you make from the muon neutrino interaction. And as you might expect, the flux that we just talked about in the previous slide is the upper boundary to what you can generate en route. So obviously there are uncertainties in these calculations. You have to know what the luminosity is. The local luminosity may not be the same as the distant luminosity, because cosmic ray protons are attenuated such that at these energies, you are really only seeing your own backyard. You can't really see beyond 100 megaparsecs or so at very high energies. But of course, the cosmic ray sources could have been much more powerful in the past at high redshift, and they would have generated a huge load of neutrinos, and those can come to us unattenuated. So therefore, might have a mismatch. You might have more neutrinos than you'd expect on the basis of the cosmic ray luminosity in your neighborhood. And of course, there is uncertainty about what the injection spectrum is, how the sources evolve, and so on and so on. So you can actually get rid of some of these uncertainties, as we did, by observing that this process will also make neutral pions, and the neutral pions will make gamma rays, and these gamma rays will cascade on the intergalactic radiation fields and ultimately end up as, you know, gamma rays that Fermi can see. So if you have a bound on the diffuse gamma ray background from Fermi, which we do, you can use that to limit the number of gamma rays that could have been generated by the GZK process. And since the ratio of neutral pions to charged pions is known, you can then correspondingly put a bound on the cosmogenic flux from the charged pions, right? So that argument is independent of, or rather circumvents, the ambiguities due to the possible evolution of the sources. So having got the neutrinos, we now have to figure out how they interact. And at these energies, the interaction is not, as Janet was saying, at low energies, you have quasi-elastic scattering and you have, you know, sort of low energy processes which are not actually particularly well known, in the sense that there are uncertainties that have to be sorted out to determine them. Really? Oh, it's okay. I'll speed up even more. At very high energies, the dominant process is deep inelastic scattering, as indicated here. And the cross-section for that, it's mediated through the W. So here is the W propagator. But it really depends on so you're interacting with a parton in the nucleus with a quark or a gluon, and you want to know what the momentum distribution of these objects is. And so the momentum is parameterized by the so-called Bjorken X, the fraction of the momentum carried by the struck parton. And the momentum transfer in the process is the invariant Q square. So the propagator, as you can see here, as Q square goes up, the cross section will go down. But as Q square goes up, the parton distribution functions are enhanced. So there are two competing effects. And you can also see from this formula that most of the contribution is coming from Q square, which is of order MW square. And the X value at that point is just this ratio here. Okay. So at very high energies, you can easily estimate what kinematic range in Q square and X you're exploring. But you need to know these so-called structure functions, and the structure functions are given at leading order quite simply in terms of the constituent quarks and the C which is becoming more and more important at low values of Bjorken X. At next to leading order, you can't calculate it so simply, but you can do so numerically. And this is the industry in itself, because these Poisson distribution functions are, of course, crucial for estimating the standard model backgrounds at the LHC. And that's why there has been a huge effort putting into getting it right at a few percent, so that if you see something funny, you would know whether it really is new physics or just some QCD higher order effect that nobody had computed. Now, that happened a lot when the SPS started up in 83, 84, 85. It's not happening now, which is why you don't get so many rumors out of the LHC. It's become a little more boring because these people have done very careful work. So this is the range of Q square and X that is explored according to what momentum transfer you're looking at. And this was calculated using one of the latest PDF sets from HERA, which just uses data from one experiment, all systematics under control. And you can see that you're going down to very, very low values of X when you're talking about very high energies, such as the cosmic ray energies I was talking about. And so what you have to do is to actually try and measure this Poisson distribution functions down to as low X values as you can in the laboratory, and you still might have to extrapolate them, and that can be done in perturbative QCD using this Lokshidze-Gribov-Lipatov-Altareli-Parisi formalism, which essentially accounts for the scaling violations, the running of the strong coupling, and gives a very good description of all data to date. So the real new development in this happened around, you know, the 2005, 2006, 2007, when the experiments that were studying electron proton scattering at Hamburg, and they were exploring this range here, as is indicated by this yellow line. So they were going down to pretty low X, and they were of course measuring the cross sections, which are in perfect agreement with perturbative QCD, which are those lines that you see there, and you can visually see the scaling violations. And when you interpret this data, you find that the distribution of the partons in the nucleon are actually not, as you might think, dominated by the valence quarks, which is the case at high X. At low X, the nucleon is basically a sea of gluons. So this is the gluon PDF multiplied by 1 over 20. I mean, otherwise it would go up like that, right? So basically the nucleon is essentially a bunch of gluons, and that does change your expectation for the cross-section due to deep inelastic scattering quite importantly when you go down to low X. So here is an example. I'm going through this rather rapidly for lack of time. You can extract the PDFs from the data with uncertainties. This is an exercise we did with the data from Zeus, one of the experiments. And when we put that into the formula for the neutrino cross-section, we found an answer which was actually up to 40% different from the one that was being used by the experiments like IceCube to actually compute how many events they should expect for a given flux. And when you set an upper limit from not having seen anything, you of course use the same cross-section, right? So we wanted to get this uncertainty down smaller than that. And of course, you have to make sure that your calculation agrees with the data that does exist on neutrino deep inelastic scattering, which is up to about 220 GeV at the time. And you can see that there's reasonable agreement at that level. Of course, there are other contributions at low energies, which are important for the experiments today. So this is rather important for experiments like IceCube, because we are really looking at energies most of the time of TeV and higher, although there is a infill called Deep Core, which is able to go down to tens of GeV, and we hope to go down still further with the proposed extension. Now, IceCube now has 7+ years of data, and it's, as you have seen before, I'm sure, a huge experiment, takes up a kilometer cube, although as the PI Francis Hulzen likes to point out, it only cost 30 cents per ton. So, you know, it's a very cheap experiment. And it's amazing that people actually build this thing, because with this, you can detect neutrino interactions, which can be up to a kilometer across. So this is the whole detector at high energies. Muons, of course, go through the detector leaving tracks, which can be quite well measured in terms of their pointing, but you don't really know the energy that well, because you just measure the muon energy from the fluctuations in the energy it's depositing, and then you have to use the theoretical inelasticity distribution to try to estimate the neutrino energy. So it's rather uncertain. But the electron and tau neutrinos would leave just charge current events, which are basically big blobs. We haven't actually seen the so-called double bang that would result from a tau being created and then decaying. At this energy, the tau travels a long way. So this has good energy resolution but poor pointing. Okay? Having said all that, with this detector, people have measured the atmospheric neutrino spectrum from around a GeV all the way up to a few times 10 to the 5 GeV in agreement with the expectation from theoretical modeling of how many pions and kaons you make in the atmosphere. You also expect a flux of prompt neutrinos, which are from charm decays. Charm is very short-lived, so it decays before it interacts. So that flux is harder, and it is important because that flux is has a spectrum which is not dissimilar from that of the cosmic spectrum that we have now been able to extract from that background. Now, that's another talk which I do not intend to give, but I'm sure you have heard talks about how IceCube has in fact managed to extract through the so-called high energy starting event criterion a small but clearly high significance detection of a cosmic neutrino flux. And it's necessary to calculate this better or to actually measure it in order to be sure of the significance of our cosmic neutrinos. And that's something, again, I can't talk about, but the bottom line is that we are actually pretty convinced now that there is no problem with this. This flux is actually lower than is indicated here. And we know that from using actual data from LHCb on hydroproduction of charm to normalize the expectation for the prompt flux. So the big picture looks like this. This is the spectrum multiplied by E square. Here is the neutrino spectrum from for atmospheric neutrinos falling very steeply. Here at high energies is the GZK neutrinos, which have not been seen yet. What we have seen is this, and then we have seen a cosmic flux, which is a very hard spectrum, like e to the minus 2, which extends up to about a few PeV. Okay? Now, this already then gives you a ready-made source of neutrinos to do experiments with, going up to 10 to the 5 GeV, which are mainly atmospheric neutrinos. Right? What can we do with that? Well, the atmospheric neutrinos are being generated isotropically because the cosmic rays are isotropic and the atmosphere of the Earth is isotropic. But the Earth is going to absorb the high-energy neutrinos. So, you know, you have all heard about neutrinos going through light years of lead. That's at low energies, okay? We are now talking about very high energies where the Earth is not transparent to neutrinos. In fact, above 30 TeV, it will start absorbing neutrinos. And this is our expectation for how the distribution of the flux should look according to what zenith angle we look at. So here is IceCube looking through the Earth. So if you look through the Earth all the way here, there will be maximum absorption, less so at a smaller zenith. And what you can then do is to take this expectation and ask if the data is consistent with this for the assumed model of neutrino interactions, which was the model that I already showed you, the calculation that I showed you. So actually, that calculation has been further improved. We have now estimated the cross-section to within a few percent accuracy. And just as an aside, I have to mention this very quickly. You actually get the same answer from independent of what PDF set you use, from the CTEC group or the Martin Stirling Thorne Weber group. Although they look very different, if you just plot them on top of each other, it turns out that if you insist that none of this PDF should give you an unphysical answer, like a negative longitudinal structure function or too steep a rise of the cross section, then they are all in agreement. So the exercise of asking whether the zenith angle distribution is consistent with what you expect from the standard model was actually done by Sandy Miyareki. She did her thesis recently at LBNL nearby. And well, all the details are here on the slides. You can see them later. Basically, her Monte Carlo and her data agree pretty well for the assumed cross-section, so that she is able to say that the cross-section cannot be any more than 30% off from the standard model calculation. And I remind you that this is now going up to 1,000 TeV, a measurement at an energy about 100 times higher than can be made at any terrestrial collider. And that is shown here graphically. This is the cross-section divided by energy. At low energies, the cross-section goes proportional to energy. But here you see the W coming in, the propagator, and then the cross-section goes as e to the 0.3. So this is proof that the W exists, in case you did not know about that earlier. You could even measure its mass, not a competitive one. And this is quite impressive, because although it's a very crude measurement, I mean, 30% is pretty, not particularly impressive, it is the first such measurement. It's not a factor of two off. We can restrict that. We can rule out radical changes to physics, which might give you a change in the neutrino cross-section here. And I should, of course, also point out that IceCube was not built to do this, right? So even if the NSF was, in a generous mood to fund it, it has had its money repaid many times over, okay? Because this is something that was not certainly in the original plan. Of course, this is only up to 10 to the 6 GeV. We can go up much further if you can see those cosmogenic neutrinos. But the rate of those is very, very small. We need a bigger detector for that, which I'll come to in a second. Just to point out if, for example, there had been a large extra dimension at a TeV, then the cross-section should have taken off like a rocket, and that is not something that we see. But of course, we didn't mention it in the paper because this has been ruled out already by the LHC, but we could have done this a few years ago. We would have got there ahead of them. Let me now please take 5 minutes, because I really must talk about this. I know it's going to cut into my question time. If you go to very low X, the density of gluon starts increasing. You already saw that at the measurements that are already made, the gluons are overtaking everything else. So at very low values of Bjork and X, the picture that we have is as follows. Here is a dilute gas of protons. As you go to very low X, that gas is getting more and more dense until they start overlapping. And you would expect that there would be some kind of recombination effect, there would be some non-perturbative effects which would change the behavior of the protons in the nucleon. And the hypothesis is that they form something called a colored glass condensate, a new state of matter, if you will, right? Now, this is something which is very topical, of great interest to people who study QCD, and it has some support from the data at colliders. But in fact, an independent way of probing this is to ask, what would it do to the neutrino-nucleon cross-section, right? And that's where those Auger tanks that I started with come in, because they actually are also good for seeing neutrinos, because they normally look at air showers which are coming vertically. And when you look horizontally through the Earth's atmosphere, you don't actually expect to see any air showers, because you are looking through many thousands of grams of air. They should absorb all the air showers. So only a muon should come through, nothing more, right? So here is an example of an event where there is only a single muon coming through, right, from a horizontal air shower. But if you saw something like a vertical air shower, which has also got a electromagnetic component, but coming horizontally, that can only be due to a neutrino, because only a neutrino can penetrate the atmosphere, get close to where you are, and then initiate an air shower. So this is a search that is underway, and what this will give you is a rate which is proportional to the neutrino flux and proportional to the cross-section. But now you compare it with another way of looking for neutrinos with Auger, which is that if the neutrino flux has tau neutrinos in it, and you would expect it to have one-third tau neutrinos through large mixing, then it can enter the Earth and emerge from the ground as a tau lepton and give you an air shower coming out of the ground. And you can only see this in that experiment because the tanks are about this high above the ground. The reason was to keep the cows on the pampa from chewing up the solar panel on the top, but that gives you a little acceptance towards the ground. Right? And it turns out that this is interesting because this rate is still proportional to the flux, but it is not proportional to the cross-section, because if I raise the cross-section, then there is more absorption in the Earth, so the two effects cancel, and the rate is almost independent of the cross-section. So if I combine the two kinds of events, then I will get a handle on the cross-section without even knowing the flux. Okay? Now, this is the expectation for how the cross-section should behave at very large energies, according to whether it's a standard model, whether you have a particular mild version of recombination, as is shown in this dashed line here, which is called the screened BFKL approximation. And this is the colored glass condensate, a significant change in the cross-section at high energies. Well, it is easy to estimate then that if the real truth is this standard model, then given the Waksman-Bacall flux, for example, I should see so many events which are quasi-horizontal and so many which are earth-skimming. But if this is the real truth, then I should instead see a far smaller number of quasi-horizontal and a different number of earth-skimming. So to the extent that I can tell the difference between this and this, I can tell the difference between that and that. Okay? So I can actually measure the cross-section at 10 to the 10, 10 to the 11 GeV with a rather cheap detector with a, well, it is true that this is super Auger. This is assumed to be, you know, 10 times the size of Auger. It was meant to be built. Unfortunately, it didn't get built, right? So there the NSF did miss a trick. For a cheap detector, it could have measured something of fundamental interest. However, just to sort of end my talk, very recently, this was just, in March, ANITA, which is this experiment which goes around the Antarctic and looks for air showers, radio emission from air showers, both directly and that coming up through the ice, and they can tell the difference from the polarization from whether it's radio emission reflected off the ice or actually coming up towards the detector that is floating up 30 kilometers in the atmosphere. So they claim that the sea events, which are anomalous, which do not look like the reflected radio signal from cosmic ray showers, and I'm not suggesting that this is a definitive detection, but it's interesting that already an extant experiment is claiming to see air showers coming up through the ground that could be due to neutrinos. But of course, when you look at how much of the Earth they came through, it cannot be neutrinos with the standard model cross-section. They would have been absorbed. So they, in fact, speculate that maybe this is because the charge current cross-section is suppressed at EEV energies, which are the energies that they're looking at. So it's kind of interesting that already one is looking at the possibility of seeing a possible suppression of the cross-section at very high energies. But that did not be so, and this is, I promise, my last slide. The cross-section might actually shoot up hugely because there are non-productivity processes in the SU2 sector, in the electric sector of the theory, which can also enhance the cross-section greatly. This is the standard model cross-section. This is the expectation of if there are transitions mediated by so-called spallerons, the corresponding energies of order 90 eV center of mass. And according to these authors, this would give rise to spectacular events in ice cube, which would release 9 TeV, and they believe that the possibility of detecting them in ice cube is actually marginally better than of detecting these things at the LHC. I have to remark that the probability for this happening is rather contentious. This is according to a recent estimate by Tai and Wong. You have to figure out how to calculate the probability of these spallerons transitions. It is technically quite complicated, but it's kind of interesting that this modest detector can once again say something possibly about the non-productive aspect of the electroweak theory. So I'm well over my time. I'm very sorry. I'm just going to end by saying that we have to think big. This is the IceCube proposal for what might come next, and this would allow us to detect cosmogenic neutrinos at the energies that we need in order to be able to study some of the phenomena I talked about. Thank you. And we are out of time.
Yeah, I mean, do we have any quick questions? Okay, maybe we can discuss over coffee then.